This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, it's good to have you with us on this wonderful day. I'm Joel Hilliker. To address the COVID pandemic, governments all over the world have been spending wildly, handing out stimulus money to protect businesses and jobs, spending for healthcare costs and other expenses. Will our economies ever recover from all of this? Well, regarding America, a new report from the U.S. Congressional Budget Office is shocking. It reveals how much this pandemic has escalated America's already sky-high national debt to even more dangerous levels. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this. China has been increasing its pressure on Taiwan. Recently, the United States made a high-level diplomatic visit to this island nation, and it looks like this really angered China. It sent 18 aircraft near the Taiwan Strait, and we're going to hear a report from Trumpet writer Rufato Manyepa about how some analysts say this was a dress rehearsal for an invasion of Taiwan. In our third segment, we'll talk about face masks. These are mandatory in more and more places in this time of COVID, although we have gotten conflicting information about them. Do they actually work? Well, our health expert, Jörg Mardian, has been looking into this. We'll talk to him about that. And finally, I'll tell you about the beautiful meaning behind a little observed festival spoken of in the Old Testament. We'll start, though, by hearing about the frightening scale of America's national debt in this report from Andrew Miller.
Americans are robbing the next generation to live beyond their means. The United States government is projected to spend $6.6 trillion in fiscal year 2020. And that's even if Congress does not pass a fifth COVID-19 stimulus package. That is despite the fact that the federal government has only collected half that amount in tax revenues. This means that the government has run up a record-breaking $3.3 trillion deficit this past year. And a new report from the Congressional Budget Office shows that the government does not intend to reduce its other spending to pay back the debt it has accrued for emergency COVID-19 expenses. Instead, it predicts trillion-dollar deficits for decades to come. The 2020 long-term budget outlook predicts that the federal debt held by the public will exceed the size of the U.S. economy next year. By 2050, this debt will be nearly double the size of the U.S. economy. Just the interest on this debt will soon exceed $1 trillion per year. And the federal debt held by the public does not include intergovernmental debt, such as the money the government's borrowed from its own Social Security funds. Such an enormous debt is not just unsustainable, it's actually sinful. The Bible says the wicked borrows and cannot pay back. That's in Psalms 37, verse 21. It also says a good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. That's in Proverbs 13, verse 22. As Nathaniel Blake at The Federalist worded it, federal deficit spending is not like going into personal debt. It's like a grandma going on a binge with her grandchildren's credit cards. It's parents signing away their children's future for some government handouts now. It's wrong to place our children and grandchildren under such tremendous debt. According to the Congressional Budget Office, federal debt held by the public will be $121 trillion in 2050. That will be over $320,000 for every man, woman, and child in the nation at that time. Just the interest on that debt is projected to be over $5 trillion a year, meaning 8% of America's entire economic output will be spent on interest. A defense analyst from the Center for Independent Studies predicts that China will outstrip U.S. military spending before 2050. And a major reason for America's declining strength is its national debt. In 2050, America is projected to spend 84% of its tax revenues on Social Security, Medicare, and other mandatory entitlements. Meanwhile, it is projected to spend 44% of its tax revenues on interest payments. Together, that is 127% of tax revenue, meaning that there will be literally less than nothing left over for national defense and running the country. Financial historian Niall Ferguson has warned that nations often fall apart when the cost of servicing their debts exceeds the cost of defending their borders. Based on current budget projections, America will be spending more on interest than on defense by the year 2033. And if interest rates increase faster than expected, this will happen much sooner. Americans can slash government spending in half, or they can double tax revenues, but they must not continue to sinfully rob future generations. This is inherently immoral. In ancient times, God instructed the Israelites that blessings come from obedience to his laws, just as cursings come from disobedience. In Deuteronomy 28, God warned that debt problems are one of the many curses that come from disobedience. Specifically, he warned that if Israel turned away from him, strangers would lend them money, but they would not lend money to other people. And this scripture describes America today exactly.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. It is a great point that you make, that I think there would be a lot of people who would disagree with the United States spending to the levels that it is, overspending to the levels that it is. But it is entirely appropriate to put this in moral terms, that it is actually sinful. When you see the way that politicians are going about this in ways that will absolutely jeopardize and destroy our children and our grandchildren in the future, there will be a day of reckoning, and they are prioritizing these short-term benefits that they're gaining in their offices over that of future generations. It really is sinful, as you said.
Right, because I mean, that's America's been kind of kicking the day of reckoning down the road, because it seems like every year the Congressional Budget Office predicts that interest is going to exceed defense within the next few years, and then the next year the interest rates on the debt go down and it buys them a little more time. But no one can deny that, like, eventually those bills do come due. The interest rates are going to hit close to zero, and the debt's going to keep going up, and eventually, like I said, the interest on that debt will be so much that, like, the next generation, like I said, they're going to be spending like 10%, 8 to 10% of the nation's entire economic output just paying the interest on the debt that their parents and grandparents accrued.
So how do these politicians and economists justify continuing to spend at the level that they are?
There seems to be two common answers as to why the debt doesn't matter. The first one is to just say that, like, hey, this is nothing we should be concerned about right now, because America's credit rating is so great that nations are going to continue lending to us, so that there's no threat that nations are going to stop lending us money anytime soon. And so we can keep racking up debt. Although that... that excuse is pretty much precisely what I was talking about in the early parts of this segment, about robbing your children or grandchildren. They're saying, like, hey, we don't need to worry about this. Our credit rating's so good that this isn't going to be a problem in our lifetimes. We've got plenty of time to get this debt under control. But kind of like the unspoken assumption is that, like, oh, yeah, well, I guess our kids will figure it out. Someday,
right,
when our credit rating isn't so good. But for now, they're like, said, you don't have to worry about the economy collapsing next year, because our credit's good and nations keep borrowing. So, I mean, yeah, you can definitely have debate between economists as to how long the credit rating is going to be good. But even those people, if they just, like, listen to their own statements, realize that, like, okay, we are robbing this from a future generation. Maybe they don't think they're robbing their children, but they admit that they're definitely robbing. If they're not robbing their children, they're robbing their grandchildren or their or their great grandchildren.
Yeah.
The other common answer that you get as to why this doesn't matter is, like, well, They said the Federal Reserve's been so obsessed with keeping inflation under 2% a year that they've been unwilling to print more money. And they said, so if they would just lighten up on that, we can just use quantitative easing, basically like money printing, to make sure our debt doesn't get out of hand. But as they must know, that when you print money, the economy is only worth so much. Mm-hmm. So the more money you print, the more slices there are in that pie of the economy, each slice being a dollar, I guess, in that analogy. So you get inflation. Mm-hmm. You're gonna get inflation. Dollars are going to be devalued. And inflation really is a secret tax on savers, because it's right. anyone who has money in a bank account, the it's not like the government's directly taxing you, but by printing money that the government spends, your money in your savings account becomes less, so they really have taxed your money. So it's basically saying you can just print your way out of this is another way of saying, yeah, we're going to start looting people's savings accounts.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a means of looting that doesn't raise eyebrows nearly as much as say, I think it was Greece, where the government actually withdrew money from those accounts, but the effect is precisely the same.
Right, and that's actually an interesting case in Greece, because everyone was shocked that Greece did that, but the reason Greece did that is because, since it's part of the Eurozone, the European Central Bank decides when to print or not print more euros. So the Greek government has no say over it. It's not. Right. They would have done that. They totally would have done that if they would have been.
If they'd have had the power to do it.
The power to do it.
So you look at the, the debt level in the United States, and the way economists look at it, it's the debt to GDP ratio that they're really concerned about. And when you look at the debt to GDP historically, we're actually in similar territory to where we were, say, around the time of World War II. And so that this is another argument that people use, that, well, you know, we've been in this case before and the country didn't burn, so why be concerned today?
Yeah, that's the most common response I've gotten whenever I've written about the national debt being a national security threat. And then people come back, they'd be like, well, the national debt was about as big as it is now in terms of debt to GDP ratio in World War II, and it didn't destroy the country. But of course, the big difference there is that, first of all, the debt was high during World War II because we were spending trillions of dollars, or the equivalent of trillions of dollars in today's money, on World War II, which everyone knew wasn't going to go forever. The war was going to end, and you were going to stop spending that money. And actually, in that particular case, it even worked that the war ended. We stopped spending that money, and we didn't have a lot of competition for people buying our manufacturing goods, because a lot of the factories in Europe that would have been our competitors had been bombed during the war. Mm. So after the war, you stopped spending money in World War II, and the GDP in the U.S. just exploded because it became a manufacturing power. Mm. And so the debt to GDP ratio went way down, and you got over that. Right now, you don't have either advantage, because it's like we didn't spend this money on a war that's going to end. I guess the COVID package is, hope the COVID pandemic people think will end, and we won't have to keep spending, or we won't keep spending COVID money, hopefully. But the Social Security and the Medicare expenses, those are just projected to go up and up and up and up and up indefinitely. So we're spending on our money mostly on stuff that's not projected to end, like World War II was projected to end. And our competition from countries like China and Japan and Europe is worse than ever. So no one's predicting a huge explosion in U.S. GDP in the near future, or a huge reduction in government spending in the near future, which means that our debt's as high as it was in World War II, and like I mentioned from the Congressional Budget Office report, is expected to be twice, not just the same size of GDP, but twice the level of GDP within the next 30 years.
So I guess looking at figures like that where it's 30 years away, a lot of people would still think this really isn't that big of a deal. We don't have to worry about it. Like, it's not going to affect us anytime soon. What do you see happening maybe in the nearer term, the next few years, as a result of this overspending?
Well, I think the one thing that even the people at the Congressional Budget Office are overlooking is they're predicting pretty low interest rates for the next 30 years.
Right.
And they're predicting that because they figure, like, well, nations, the dollar is the reserve currency. When you're the reserve currency nation, most financial transactions around the world, like over half the financial transactions around the world, are conducted in dollars. So people need dollars. So they're going to keep buying U.S. Treasury bonds. Even if the interest rate's low, they'll take whatever low interest we offer them and be grateful for it. I mean, it gets to a point when your debt gets high enough and you start having to do quantitative easing and money printing to pay the interest on your debt, nations get jittery about using a nation with that high of a debt level as a reserve currency. And so you already see is that nations are very uncomfortable using the dollar as the reserve currency. They kind of keep doing it just because they haven't come up with a good alternative yet, but they're actively looking for that alternative. Mm-hmm. And if they find it, then when you're not the reserve currency anymore, they don't need to accept your low interest rates. They can start charging 10-11% interest on a treasury bond like they did in the 80s. Mm-hmm. In which case, you're not looking at 26% of tax revenues going to interest on the debt in the year 2050. You're looking at like all of tax revenues going to interest on the debt in 2050, which,
or even far sooner,
or far
even a small raise in the interest rate would be catastrophic.
Right, we already spend like 2-3% of GDP on interest. So yeah, if the interest rate and our interest are like less than 2% right now, so if they went back up to 10%, that would be 5. So yeah, you'd be looking at 10% of GDP on interest alone, and you get an what some economists call like an economic death spiral, to where you're basically borrowing money to pay the interest on the money you already borrowed. And then you have to borrow more money to pay the interest on the money you borrowed. And it just gets down to where you start seeing like you've got to print so much. You're looking at Weimar Germany levels of inflation, where you start like papering your house with Deutschmarks because it's cheaper than the wallpaper. But
well, just to return to your initial point, it is sinful to be overspending the way that we are, and sin always brings penalties, and those penalties are coming. Even if we haven't experienced the worst of them yet, they are coming. We thank you for that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about America's skyrocketing debt in this time of COVID-19. He wrote an article about this, America's Debt is Sinful. Look for that at thetrumpet.com. And thank you, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
China has long threatened domination over the island nation of Taiwan. Some say it is actually rehearsing to invade, as we will now hear in this report from Rufaro Manyepa.
On September 18, China deployed 18 different aircraft dangerously close to the sensitive midline of the Taiwan Straits. This deployment was in response to U.S. Undersecretary of State Keith Krach's diplomatic visit to Taiwan. And so two bombers were seen escorting 16 fighter jets to hold combat exercises in Taiwan's air defense identification zone. And after that, the Chinese Ministry of National Defense came out and said, "Those who play with fire are bound to get burned." In a statement of its forceful opposition to the diplomatic meetings being held between the U.S. and Taiwan. In fact, the Global Times, a Chinese paper controlled by the ruling Chinese Communist Party, wrote that the collusion between the U.S. and Taiwan could lead to uncertainties in the entire region. Taiwan has been doing its best to bolster its defensive capabilities. In fact, it's increased its defense budget by 10%, and over the last 4 years has engaged in $13 billion worth of arms deals with the United States. And just a few days before this diplomatic visit, the U.S. and Taiwan announced that they were close to agreeing to another $7 billion arms deal, which would see Washington supply Taiwan with drones, fighter jets, cruise missiles, and ground control stations. And this deal is likely to have rankled in Beijing, as China has often reiterated its desire to reclaim what it calls the renegade province of Taiwan. And so it's not uncommon for China to hold air drills near or around Taiwanese airspace, but never before have these exercises involved so many Chinese aircraft approaching from multiple directions. In fact, according to Professor Drew Thompson of the National University of Singapore, these flight exercises were intended to test Taiwan's ability to simultaneously track multiple offensive forays. In addition to this, Chinese flotillas were seen practicing mine clearing to open up sea lanes for warships and landing forces. And even Chinese soldiers have vowed to give up their lives should there be a war against Taiwan. The People's Liberation Army's Eastern Theater Command said that if one day the war breaks out, we would rush to the battlefield without any hesitation. We will protect every inch of the land of the motherland, every flower and every blade of grass. We would never let down the motherland and our people. The Global Times went on to write, therefore, that these drills were no longer just demonstrations of power, but deliberately planned invasive strategies with real combat application. It went on to say, quote, "Every time a high-ranking U.S. official visits Taiwan, the PLA, the People's Liberation Army jets, should be one step closer to the island. If the U.S. Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense comes to Taiwan, the PLA should fly its aircraft over the island and conduct exercises above it. The missiles we test should also fly over Taiwan, even its presidential office building. If Taiwan authorities continue to act aggressively, such scenarios will definitely come true." End quote. China desperately wants to reclaim Taiwan. It is determined to do so by any means. In fact, in 2019, Chinese President Xi Jinping said it himself, "We do not promise to renounce the use of force and reserve the option to use all necessary measures." Before, the threat of American intervention would have been enough to dissuade China from its designs on Taiwan, and yet now China is readily rehearsing its invasion of Taiwan as American officials are in Taiwan. And the Global Times said that once the People's Liberation Army dispatches troops to reunify the island of Taiwan with mainland China, the military equipment from the U.S. will be nothing but decorations. Listen to this. They said that promoting relations with the U.S. is nothing but a way to quench its thirst by drinking poison. The piece went on to warn that the exercise drills gave the People's Liberation Army crucial data on Taiwan's defense systems in these rehearsals for the invasion of Taiwan. The reality is that Taiwan would not be able to withstand an invasion by China. Taiwan broke away from mainland China in 1949 when Chinese nationalists, defeated by Mao Zedong's Communist Party, fled the 90 miles across the water to the island of Taiwan. Mao had planned to invade the island the next year, but had to abort it when the Korean War broke out. But ever since then, there have been periods of high tension between the mainland and Taiwan, and Beijing has had a serious design to reclaim this island. All the while, this has been deterred by America's presence in the region, and so China has never attacked. But America's protective stance over Taiwan, which so often has been a deterrent, now seems to be a motivator of Chinese aggression. The question, therefore, is whether or not the U.S. would be willing to engage in a military confrontation with China over the island. Bible prophecy answers this question emphatically. In Leviticus 26, God outlines the parameters of his covenant with Israel, primarily the United States and Britain today, in which he promises blessings for obedience and curses for disobedience. God tells America in this end time that he will break the pride of your power and your strength shall be spent in vain because of the nation's sins. Today, sin and lawlessness are rampant in the United States, and as a consequence, God has broken the pride of America's power. The United States might indeed make more deals with Taiwan, supplying them with equipment, and might even make condemnatory statements of China's intentions. But even if America were to be involved in a military campaign in defense of Taiwan, the Bible shows that America has won its last war. This is why our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, wrote that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China. And these 23 million people are going to be forced into the Chinese mold, and it is going to happen for one reason: because of a pitifully weak-willed America. Once conquered, Taiwan is going to be part of a prophesied Asiatic military alliance that is going to shape global events in a powerful way.
Thank you for that, Rufaro. This really seems to fit a larger pattern of Chinese aggression that we see unfolding in a lot of different theaters in the world. And you can't help but notice just how defiant they are in the face of America, that they really don't seem to have any fear of the United States right now. They seem to be very willing to take advantage of what it seems they perceive as America's weakness. What are some of the reasons why you believe China is making this move so aggressively now?
Well, first is the matter of Chinese nationalism. It's so great a talking point in China right now. It's so deeply ingrained in the Chinese psyche, the nationalistic pride that is associated with the idea of taking back Taiwan. It's something that China has wanted to do ever since Taiwan left. It's something that Chairman Mao wanted to do immediately as soon as it happened, and he wasn't able to do it. And President Xi Jinping has stated again and again that this is something he wants to do in the vision for China up until 2050. Having reclaimed Taiwan is one of the foremost goals on his agenda. And you can see even with the Chinese soldiers themselves, the idea of reclaiming Taiwan is one that they're willing to die for. It's something that the Chinese see as something that they have to do in order to fulfill their own perceived greatness. They believe that they're a great people, and they believe that they have to be reunified with Taiwan, and they're willing to do whatever it is that is necessary to do this.
You know, that has been a goal of China for so long. And Gerald Fleury wrote that article, Taiwan Betrayal, back in 1998. He was talking about it back then. And of course, it goes back to the time that Taiwan became independent. But essentially, you're saying that This has been a goal for a long time, and it's just a matter of finding the right opportunity. Now it appears China says the opportunity is there.
Right, because China right now has really terrible relations with the United States. And so its respect for the United States as far as what it believes is right or wrong counts for absolutely nothing. But then China is also looking at the situation in the United States right now. Everyone is divided over the Black Lives Matter riots and protests and the coronavirus and the upcoming elections. And in fact, former CIA officials and scholars in America believe that China could invade Taiwan as soon as the presidential inauguration, or even as the United States is going to the polls in just a month or two. And that's because they're anticipating that with all the division and disunity in the United States, that's going to be enough to be a distraction for the United States to be unable to stop Beijing from going to reclaim Taiwan. They're anticipating that all this disunity, the discord, the disharmony in America is going to be the perfect time for China to go and reclaim Taiwan. And we can see that every single day on the news. That, and it doesn't look like it's going to be stopping at any time. And China believes that now is the perfect time to be able to accomplish this.
Well, we will definitely keep our eyes on what's happening there to see if they follow through. It is very alarming to see the moves that they're making right now. I'm sure the people of Taiwan are taking these threats very seriously. We appreciate that, Rufaro. We've been talking with trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about China's desire to take over Taiwan, evidence that it is actually rehearsing an invasion of that island nation. He's written an article about this called China Rehearses Invasion of Taiwan. You can read that at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for coming in.
Always a pleasure, sir.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Face masks are everywhere in this time of COVID-19. Early on during the pandemic, many experts advised us not to use them. Well, now it's far in the other direction. We have to wear them everywhere with threats of fines and shaming for those who don't do so. But do the masks actually work? The answer might not be what we've been led to believe. To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia our health expert, Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hello there.
So let's get straight to it. Do the masks work?
Well, they work in a small way. They do not work in the way that we're told. I mean, if you look at all the evidence right now that's before us, and it's easy to dig up, but it's not easy to hear on the national news. And they have a small factor of redeeming qualities, but they also make the situation even a little more dangerous. And that's really what I want to talk about today. There's a false sense of security with masks, for sure. Mm-hmm. Not only in what the media tells us in the way that we overestimate this virus, but in how we wear these and what we believe it actually does. And we believe it's like a little fail-safe, but it's not. The first thing is that, you know, many people overestimate this virus. And that's something that we have to look at when we're testing to say, you know, what is the value of these masks? I think right now there's about 205,000 people killed. I looked at the latest statistics officially.
And that's in the U.S.?
That's in the U.S., yes. Yep. And that represents 0.06% of the population. So looking back on April 18th, if you look at the stats, a virus goes up and then it drops. That's the pattern of most viruses. On April 18th, just over 17,000 people died in 1 week. So they're taking 1 week patterns. That was the peak, the absolute peak. By September, it dropped to 280 weekly deaths. So we're at the bottom of the chart right now. And remember, this is a nation of 328 million people, so we have to look at this in perspective. In fact, the virus is such a weakling, looking at the stats, that the number of sick had and dying had to be grossly exaggerated. The CDC just released data that shows only 6% of the people who actually died had COVID-19 as a primary cause.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So remember, these are statistics driving the fear towards face masks.
Yeah.
The other 94% had comorbidity factors, multiple secondary health complications as contributing causes. So the stats don't look good for the mask usage.
Okay, so so the masks themselves, there are a lot of scientists that are saying that this is the only way to prevent the spread of this disease. You're saying the spread is already dropping quite a lot, although there is, it looks like recent statistics show that the number of cases is growing up. So what's the evidence that you're looking at to show, say, to counteract this idea that the more masks, the better?
The famous secondary wave.
Yeah.
We've all heard about that one. So the face mask narrative was how many people died. Now the goalpost has moved to counting death cases, positive results. And that's really a massive shift. And it has to do with the testing. So the more people we test, of course, the more we're going to find. But the gold standard right now is called a polymerase chain reaction test, a PCR test, what they're using. But once again, there's problems surfacing with this. Many studies show that the potential for false positives is just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
So they use what's called a genetic photocopying technique of material collected on swabs. And that's so sensitive that they can actually pick up fragments of dead virus from previous infections. And remember, too, that you're only infectious for 10 days. These tests can actually pick up 90 days worth mm-hmm. of virus material. So that tells us that most of what they're picking up is dead virus. There's a professor, Carl Hennigan of the British Medical Journal. He says, really, that throws the norms of clinical reasoning right out the window, what I'm just talking about. And he says that proves that the PCR test does not equal COVID-19. And again, remember, the fear of cases is what's driving this renewed interest in face masks. In my little town here in Osoyoos, British Columbia, most businesses are starting with face masks now.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with this driving of how many people are getting it. And my reaction is always, well, so what? Who's dying?
So you're basically looking at the number of cases of infection as an artificially inflated number because of the nature of the testing. If you're looking at the deaths, that's it's harder to inflate that number. How much stock do you put in the, say, the death statistics based on what you've seen?
Well, deaths are 205,000 officially, but I don't put stock into that either, because when you look at the statistic, it shows that those have been inflated by up to 30-40%, you know, and we look at the numbers of people in some states that have been put in nursing homes. Infected people with older people, the exact opposite of what we're supposed to do. The number of people who had secondary conditions and couldn't get into the hospital who died because we know that was the primary reason, but if they did have COVID traces, then it will be counted as a COVID case.
Mm-hmm.
There's some evidence that shows, you know, the statistics on this are very high. So you have the death cases that are not what they're supposed to be. But again, the death cases are now, you know, we flattened the curve. No matter what the death rate was, we flattened the curve. That was the original intent. Now we're to testing. And there's some studies that show they have up to 80.3% false positive rate.
Wow.
you know. So for perspective, 80% of 205,000, that's roughly 164,000 false positives. That leaves about 41,000 true COVID cases. So that's numbers well below the flu average.
Yeah.
You know?
So so just to return to the idea of the face masks, obviously there is a lot of fear over this virus out there, and people are they're using the face mask as the main defense against it, along with social distancing. That's a very common measure, staying 6 feet away. But the face masks themselves, in your view, you said earlier that you feel like they are effective at some things, but not what we're being told. What are they good at, and what are they not good at?
Right. So the first thing that has to be established is there a standard in a face mask? What is the standard to be called effective? And the standard is really the N95, the form-fitting mask. When it comes to the public, there's absolutely no standard. You can have a surgical mask, a cloth mask, a bandana. You can wrap a tissue around your nose with a rubber band and call it whatever. Nobody's going to stop you.
Yeah.
I've seen people cover their face with their hands coming into my business. And none of these are considered personal protective equipment because of the fit. So in essence, the standard is not there. Let's talk about the surgical mask first. The N95 is proven. Studies prove that they do work quite good. Surgical masks, though, which most people put a lot of stock in, they're not even able to keep out dust particles, which are roughly 40 micrometers in diameter. A micrometer is about a thousandth of a millimeter. It's quite small. Now, the COVID-19 virus molecule measures about 0.1 micrometer in diameter. Mm. It's 400 times smaller. So imagine how much more easily that can get into that mask. It's what we call a nano-sized particle. And if that nano-sized particle, the weave of the surgical mask must look mile wide to it, you know? And a cloth mask is worse. It fails at a disastrous 97%, according to studies.
Wow.
You know, so... redeeming quality of a face mask. If you're going to sneeze, it's going to stop a lot of the large respiratory droplets that would get onto somebody. While there will be some that get through. Now, however, here's the interesting part of all this, which you will not hear anywhere. When you sneeze or when you cough, there's a discharge of roughly 100 to 1,000 droplets. And they travel about 10 meters a second. When you sneeze, it generates roughly 1,000 to 10,000 particles at 20 meters a second. So basically, it's a violent discharge. Now, where does that go in a mask that's not form-fitting? So that's the first question I asked. What's the standard here? Because they're going to escape. So the studies show that these are going to escape upwards, sideways, downwards, and backwards. I was stunned. If you're standing behind someone, you will actually get hit just as hard as if they're sneezing into your face.
Wow.
Now, to me, you know, when somebody sneezes, what's the first thing they do? They turn their head, even with a mask, and they'll sneeze into their arm. Now, when you turn your face sideways, those escaping particles aren't going to cover that person in front of you. Absolutely. And you know, safer at the side or in the back. So you see, there's when you look at these masks and you say, people say, I'm helping you, you're helping me, we're all safe. No, we're not. We're absolutely not. Just a little study is required. Dr. Fauci, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease expert, he should know this.
Yeah.
But he won't tell us because he's stat driven. Now, there's countries with the lowest observance of face mask usage. They're the Nordic nations of Norway and Sweden and Finland. 80% of people there do not wear masks. Okay? In Spain and Italy, 80% of people do wear masks. And yet the Nordic countries have fared better than Spain and Italy. So there's something else going on besides face masks. And face masks also have other qualities which are a little bit nasty. I exhale carbon dioxide. You know, now putting a mask on your face means that carbon dioxide decreases oxygen levels. You're just not getting the same amount of oxygen behind the mask. I just put one on yesterday because I have to travel. And the weave is quite tight in it. I think they put like 7 layers. I immediately had this, I couldn't breathe properly. I'm just not used to it. I have to get a lighter mask for sure. Mm-hmm. So my oxygen levels go down quite fast. Now, what does that do? It drops the blood pH levels, which we don't want. And that eventually causes an impairment in immunity and a rise in infections, including COVID-19. Because your immunity is your bulwark against COVID-19. So now people touch their faces up to 20 times a day. An hour. You could touch it 100 times a day. And what that does, it's going to get those germs on the mask. And when you don't use it, it's on the kitchen table. It's in a glove compartment of the car. It's in a purse. I mean, they're literally petri dishes. Not everybody gets a new mask every time they use it.
Right.
So these masks, in reality, most people use masks that are no more sanitary than unwashed hands.
That's ugly. So if the masks aren't the solution, what is the solution?
Well, striking the right balance between risk and disease suppression should be done prudently, you know, and not with political and totalitarian reaction. We need to obey government laws, of course.
Yep.
But we don't need to invest confidence in man's solutions like the masks. You know, there should be no confidence in that because they're not what they say they are. The real solution, when you look at it, is God's word. He says, blessed is the man that trusts in the Lord and whose hope the Lord is, in Jeremiah 17:7. That's really the real solution. And that's the only source of real and living hope. If I had to put my hope in man, I wouldn't have much confidence in that.
Well, very interesting. Lots of good nuggets there. We thank you for that very much, Jörg. We've been talking with Jörg Mardian about face masks, and he is working on an article about this subject you can watch for at thetrumpet.com. As always, we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Scrolling through the radio dial a few years back, I heard mention of the words Feast of Tabernacles. Aha, I keep this festival. I have my whole life. It's very rare to hear it mentioned on the radio, though. The church behind this radio ad keeps a form of this observance each year. Its website gives some important history of this biblically mandated observance. It quotes passages in Leviticus 23, Numbers 29, Deuteronomy 16. This is what the website said. Sukkot, the feast's Hebrew name, commences the 15th day of Tishri, that's the seventh month on the Hebrew calendar, 5 days after Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement. It lasts 7 days, the website continues, with an eighth day, Shmini Atzeret, spent as an added day of rest. This feast occurs during late September or October. So all that information is true. The Philadelphia Church of God keeps these two festivals. They add up to a total of 8 days, and we keep these by those dates on the Hebrew calendar each year. But the folks who put this ad together, they celebrate Tabernacles, quote unquote. They celebrate it a couple of weeks later for just 3 days, and they say, well, that's close enough. An important biblical principle that I've come to appreciate over the years is encapsulated in Psalm 111 and verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all they that do his commandments. In other words, proper reverence for God leads to wisdom, and obedience precedes understanding. Now, the corollary of that is this. People who refuse to obey biblical instructions they don't understand are guaranteeing that they'll never understand them. As Jesus said, God hides his truth from those who are wise in their own sight, and he reveals it to babes. Herbert W. Armstrong, early in his married life, he began studying the scriptures and found commands to observe the Feast of Tabernacles and six other annual festivals. He wrote, "I didn't know why. I only knew that God said, do it. My wife and I did, alone, for 7 years. Now, at that point, congregations of what would later become the Worldwide Church of God began to form, and the Armstrongs kept those biblical festivals with those church members for 7 more years, still not understanding their meaning. He wrote, "For 14 years, we kept these annual holy days because we saw that God commanded it. We wanted to obey. In due time, God revealed to me and I to the church why." The Feast of Tabernacles is loaded with rich spiritual and symbolic significance. The church that keeps a 3-day conference of its own choosing, well, they say that keeping the feast has become an annual tradition. They say it's important to, quote, "understand our Jewish roots, the feasts, and how they apply to the believer. It is a celebration to be enjoyed by both Christians and Jews alike." Now, their feast seems to be pretty much a demonstration of solidarity with the Jews. But their statement that this celebration is for Christians and Jews alike, it's far more literally true than they realize. First of all, the Jews, which are biblical Judah, they constituted only one tribe among the 12-tribed nation of Israel. The other modern Israelite nations include America. And if you want proof of that, just ask us. We'll give you a free copy of Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. But more importantly, the Feast of Tabernacles is not just for the physical descendants of ancient Israel. It's for everybody. And it's not just a tradition. It is a commanded assembly. Jesus kept it every year. Paul and the other apostles kept it long after the crucifixion. And once Christ returns and establishes his kingdom on earth, all nations will observe this annual festival. There's actually a prophecy of that in Zechariah 14. So we should certainly be keeping it today. That church says that the feast's major theme is joy and thanksgiving. Now, in a shallow sense, that's true. But in truth, the major theme of the feast is something far more awesome. Another name for this event is the Feast of Ingathering. You can see that in Exodus 23 and other places. It celebrated the ingathering of the late summer or early autumn harvest. But there are a lot of scriptures show that it pictures a prophesied ingathering of human beings into the family of God during the 1,000-year period known as the millennium. Anciently, the Israelites celebrated the feast by traveling to Jerusalem and living in tabernacles or temporary dwellings. It was a massive, literal ingathering of scattered peoples. And this happy scene anticipated the time in the world tomorrow when people of all nations will gather in Jerusalem to keep the feast. Today, feastgoers from many countries assemble at more than a dozen pre-selected sites worldwide. Uprooted from their normal lives, we meet, worship, and fellowship together with people of all different ages, races, backgrounds, and personalities, yet as one spiritual family. The festival theme of rejoicing is established in Deuteronomy 16. The Living Bible says this, "This will be a happy time of rejoicing together with your family." And this passage says that not only should parents rejoice with their children, but also that everyone should rejoice. Everyone needs to be looked after, foreigners, servants, widows, fatherless. Now that makes sense when you understand that this festival pictures the time when God opens his family up to everybody. Everyone rejoices together, and it pictures the prophesied time when the whole world will live together in peace and harmony under God. I've kept the Feast of Tabernacles all my life, and it truly does get better every year. Obeying the commandment as God gave it brings unanticipated blessings and rewards, not the least of which is an enhanced understanding of the tremendous prophetic vision wrapped up in this magnificent festival. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Miller, Rufato Manyepa, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Dwight Eisenhower. If you want total security, go to prison. There you're fed, clothed, given medical care, and so on. The only thing lacking is freedom. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.